American Chopper Shop, except the place was a mess. I kept expecting Paul Sr. to storm out of the office and start screaming at Polly and Vinny about the shop being dirty. Mike was about 40, had an orange Daytona Bike Week headband on, a white goatee, and was covered in axle grease or some other dirty mechanical fluid. Cliff was about 35, in a plaid lumberjack jacket, a gold rope chain, and I think had at least two dips in, maybe more. They both looked like tow truck drivers. And I don't mean that as an insult, it's just the impression I gave off. At first, we just sat around and drank beer and bullshitted. It took a while, but once I realized I wasn't some uppity city boy prima donna who thought he was better than them, they warmed up to me. So, Mike, on the ride over here, Doug said that his truck was a lot better than yours. Shit. His little girl truck couldn't pull a tampon out of a sick horse pussy. Doug said that your truck is just like bad pussy. It stinks. Son, there ain't no such thing as bad pussy. Mike, you haven't had enough pussy to say some shit like that. Well, you must fuck a lot, boy, because you ain't had a long enough dry spell to think pussy can be bad. Touche. Don't use no goddamn French around me, boy. Holla. I guess nigger's better than French. You shouldn't say nigger, Mike. If you must, at least say urban. You got too much goddamn education, boy. Doug had something broken on his truck, and his buddies helped him work on it for a few hours. I just stood around drinking Keystone Light and watching because I don't know shit about anything mechanical. Mike turns to me at one point. Tucker, hand me that crescent wrench. What's a crescent wrench? God damn. You about as useful as tits on a bull. All that education, you don't know nothing. Cliff chimes in. He sure know how to drink my beer without paying for it. But the highlight had to be listening to them talk shit to Doug. Doug says, I only have about 40,000 miles on that thing. I don't know how the U-joint broke. Right, because having a dumbass driver who's always hopping curbs and smoking his tires don't got nothing to do with it. Fuck you, bitch. I hope you brought some tequila, Doug. We ain't doing this shit for free. I ask, all it takes is a bottle of tequila to pay you two off? This is some serious mechanical work you were doing. Mike says, hell no. But tequila's the only thing that's going to wash the taste of dick out of Doug's mouth. Cliff says, you would know about that, wouldn't you? Well, I was in the fucking Navy, asshole. After they got Doug's truck fixed, we headed to Cliff's house to drink more beer and blow things up. Cliff's place was hilariously redneck. As we drive up, three dogs that look more like coyotes came running up and barking and jumping around. Sitting on a nice 2-acre piece of land is a big double-wide trailer, very nice by trailer standards. It is flanked by two huge storage sheds with ATVs, boat hulls, a beer fridge, animal skins mounted on the wall, and all other order of tools and sheet metal and whatnot. In the huge backyard is a rock pond that is really nice and well put together, with a working fountain in the middle. Next to the pond is an old three-wheeler, up on blocks. Really, it was up on concrete blocks. Fucking awesome. All the way in the back is an animal pen that has donkeys and goats. We go to the pen because Cliff wants to show everyone something behind it. Mike says, hey Cliff, what the fuck's wrong with that Billy? The male goat, called the Billy Goat, had a torn and bleeding ear. We walk into the animal pen, and laying on the ground is a dead goat with half its face missing. Across the pen are two dead baby goats, both dirty and mangled. Everyone just kind of stands there for a second. One of the dogs, the big male one, sticks his head through the gate, sees Cliff standing there, and takes off running with his tail between his legs. Cliff explodes. Chevy, get back over here! You goddamn motherfucker, get over here! Cliff stomps across the yard after the dog. He is pissed. Oh shit, there he goes. I ask Mike, why is he so mad? You see them goats, Helen Keller? That goat's been dead a long time. Its face is half decomposed. No, no. That goat was alive this morning. Then how did its face get like that? It's decomposed. You dumbass. The dogs ate it. No way. Are those dogs wild? Hell no. They're just normal house dogs. Normal dogs wouldn't do that. Shit. You got dogs? Yeah, man. I grew up with dogs, and I have two now. Well, your dogs do the same thing. They're all sweet and nice around humans, but you get them in a pack and they go fucking nuts. Domesticated or not, them's wild animals at heart. Chevy's a ringleader, and he's done this for. That's why Cliff's so pissed. He should know better. A gunshot rang out, and I kind of jumped. We turned towards the yard and saw Cliff, red as a beet, screaming and chasing his dog around, a shovel in one hand and a .22 rifle in the other. The dog was scurrying this way and that, dodging gunshots and shovel swings. It looked like a hee-haw skit. Cliff is yelling, "You stupid, stupid dog!" Swings the shovel and misses. Why the fuck do you keep doing that? Another gunshot rings out and misses. Get over here and get your whooping. Swings a shovel and misses. How many times am I going to have to beat you? Another missed gunshot. I ask Mike, is he really shooting at his dog? Oh, hell yeah. Cliff's a pretty level guy, but when he gets mad, you better watch out. He'll calm down after he tones the dog for a little bit. Tones the dog? What does that mean? Wait till he catches him, you'll see. A few seconds later, I see Cliff swing a shovel and hear the distinctive tong of metal against skull as he clocks the dog flush in the head. Much to my surprise, the dog took the hit and ran off with no noticeable damage. I didn't know whether to laugh because of the absurd comedy inherent in watching a fuming redneck chase his dog around his yard with a shovel and a gun, or be sad because some guy just hit a dog in the head with a shovel. Mike says, "You hear that sound the shovel made on his skull? That's why we call it Tony." Wow. I mean, I've never seen anyone work a dog over like that. I've never even seen anyone work a person over like that. Pimps don't even beat hookers who are short money like that. Oh, Chevy will be fine. He's tough and he's obstinate. Dogs is like women. Sometimes talking don't work. After Cliff was too exhausted to chase the dog any longer, he stormed back to the animal pen, shovel in hand but no rifle, sweat pouring off his brow, still muttering to himself. I ask Mike, "Why is he so mad? It's just a goat. He can buy another one." "Well, he ain't got much money, and them goats is worth about $150. Mike goes behind the animal pen to what can only be described as a small pet cemetery. There is a pine cross up with a goat's name and rocks all over the grave. Cliff starts digging a new grave next to the old one. The digging eventually calms Cliff down, and all of us start trading drinking stories. I tell them a few of my classics, and they laugh. Doug says, "Cliff, tell Tucker one of your stories." Cliff says, "Well, there was that weekend I tore my intestine from Burr. I went to the doctor, and he asked me how many beers I drank. I said I had about an average Saturday, about 50. Pretty hairy Sunday, had about 70. They called in two more doctors and a whole mess of nurses. Them fuckers didn't believe me. I asked them, how the hell else am I going to tear my intestine from beer unless I drank me a shitload of it?" You drank 120 beers in 2 days? No fucking way. You sound like the fucking doctors. That's over 1,400 ounces of beer. That's like 10 gallons in 2 days. Well, thank you, Mr. Wizard. We know how much fucking beer it is. I'm in awe of that. Shit, that ain't nothing. Around here, 120 beers is what we call the weekend. After a while, Chevy came over and sort of crawled near us, but stayed out of reach, obviously not wanting to get another whipping. He laid about 10 yards away, licking his crotch. I was staring at him, and I say, just out loud, "Man, I wish I could do that." Mike says, "I don't think he'd let you." Cliff finished digging and paused to stare at the dead goat for a minute. He says, "I kind of want to keep that goat head mounted above my fireplace, but I can't." Doug says, "Well, why not?" "Because every time I look at it, I hit my dog again." We threw the goats into the grave, and Mike jokingly took a full Keystone Light and threw it in the grave before he filled it in. "That's for the trip, you stupid goats." Cliff said, "Sad part is, when I'm broke jonesing for a burr, I'm going to dig that motherfucker up and drink it. Boy, I'd really get your goat. Fuck you. Cliff, you feeling all right? You look like you just buried a goat. I'm going to tone you in a minute if you don't shut the fuck up." The night we almost died. This story occurred April 1999 and was written July 2001. There are fun nights, there are crazy nights, and then there are those nights that make men legends. It was a Saturday night in law school. Me and about four friends, Hate, Golden Boy, Brown Hall, and Credit, had collected at El Benjeroso's apartment. El Benjeroso had a college fraternity brother in town, Thomas, and wanted to show him a good time. We got there around 7 p.m. and immediately began cooking large quantities of meat and drinking lots of alcohol. El Benjeroso, who lives with his fiancée, was excited about seeing his college friend and began attacking the natty light. His fiancée, Christy, knowing El Benjeroso's proclivity towards unruly drunken behavior, caught me in a corner and made me promise to stay sober so I could drive. Owing her a favor, I agreed. Though pissed at the time, it became the best decision I've ever made in my life. All the meat and liquor in the apartment consumed, we headed out. It was decided that we needed to try a new bar. Someone mentioned that a place called Shooters 2 had a mechanical bull. This was an easy call. By the time we arrived, El Benjeroso and Thomas were so drunk they were singing Johnny Cash songs and kicking cars in the parking lot. The rest of the party was not doing much better. Hate, normally an edgy person anyway, was so drunk he was eyeing stop signs suspiciously. Having wrestled with Jim Beam for the past 2 hours and lost, he was ready for a fight. Brownhole and Golden Boy were already staggering. I started to mentally prepare for the worst. We paid $2 to get the obligatory bracelets. The girl behind the counter was dressed in a tight red Lycra cowgirl outfit, replete with white lace and frills. Her boots were black and white snakeskin, but it was a white leopard print 10-gallon hat that really brought the outfit together. This bar was decorated in classic neo-western roadhouse. Longhorns, oil cans, and saddles decorated the walls. I half expected Patrick Swayze to be smacking around unruly townies. I was so busy looking at the redneck paraphernalia, I failed to notice it before I heard Hate gasp, "No way, this is awesome." In the center of the bar was something I had never seen before in my life. Live professional wrestling. Let's be clear about this. There was a ring, a full wrestling ring set up in the middle of the bar, and there were people, ostensibly professionals, in the ring wrestling each other. I must have stood there for a good 3 minutes, trying to let my brain catch up with my eyes. A real-life ring right in the middle of the bar. Two sweaty, out-of-shape wrestlers grappling, and a white banner behind the ring, proclaiming for all to see, this is the Southern Wrestling Association. Hate is the first into action. Being an ex-high school wrestler, completely shithoused, and constantly filled with rage, he immediately pushed his way through the layers of crowd to arrive ringside, and began yelling curses at the wrestlers. These fucking clowns are awful. My grandmother could wrestle better than this. You're lucky I'm not in there. All you cock-smoking pussies, let me wrestle. I'll kick their fucking asses. This continued for a good 5 minutes. All of us were mesmerized, drunkenly fixated on the surreal comedy playing out before our eyes. To Hate's credit, the guys in the ring were not in good shape. If by not in good shape, I mean fat and disgusting. A mere one beer later, Hate made his move. He stepped over the ropes that separated the crowd from the ring and began banging on the canvas, yelling at the wrestlers. A bouncer told him to stop. Hate takes this as a cue to get into the ring. Two bouncers pulled him out of the ring before he could climb all the way in. We collected Hate from the bouncers, promised that he will behave, and gave him another beer. Hate continued repeating, my grandmother kicked their asses, this is a complete joke, over and over to himself. Then I noticed how much we stood out. We were dressed in the standard grad school uniform, khakis and button-downs. No one around us shared our fashion sense. They were dressed in redneck casual, dirty blue jeans and assorted Trailer Park shirts, like WWF shirts with logos like, come smell what the Rock is cooking on it. The better dressed had on cowboy hats, cowboy boots, flannel shirts, and clean blue jeans. Having grown up in Kentucky, I knew that these sorts of people generally don't take kindly to those they perceive as rich and snobbish, especially when they've been drinking. I filed that thought under obvious foreshadowing. By this time, Hate had separated from us and found his way into a discussion with a group of younger rednecks about the relative merits of the North versus the South. Hate is from Pennsylvania. They did not share his views. He claimed that he could whip any wrestler in the bar that night. Two of the rednecks, one very fat, claimed to be cousins of one of the wrestlers, the one called Motorbike Mike, or some such bullshit. Hate questions the sexuality of their cousin. A girl in the group claimed to be the girlfriend of Motorbike Mike. Hate questioned her taste in men, her moral turpitude, and her intelligence. The fat one, the alleged cousin of Motorbike Mike, who was apparently also somehow a relative of the girl, also took exception to this. He was about 6'1", making him a good 8 inches taller than Hate. He had thick glasses, so horribly smudged I wanted to rip them off his face and clean them on my shirt. Remember, I'm sober. His white tank top shirt had grease and ketchup stains on it, only partially covering the George Strait logo. The redneck desperately needed a course in logic. He was losing an argument to someone so drunk he tried to climb into a wrestling ring. Hate made the point. The South is full of inbreds and rednecks. How are you related to both of them? The redneck tried to explain. I'm not able to follow. And I'm sober. Hate ignores him. None of this changes the fact that they're dating and they're related. That is incest. You are Southern inbred trash. Yeah, well, the North is just a bunch of rich bitches. Possibly. But that doesn't change the fact that you have not responded to me. You are obviously an idiot also. Well, you ain't worth a shit, neither is the North. Okay. That's a great comeback. You're making my point for me, moron. Bitch, I'll fight your ass. We'll see who's better than you, rich bitch. A few more minutes of this, and the wrestling round mercifully ended, creating a short break in the action. I pulled Hate away from this stimulating conversation, and we joined everyone else at the bar. Hate ordered shots for the group. After a post-shot round of beers, the mechanical bull started up. Hate not only signed himself up, but continuously yelled across the bar at the fat redneck with his smudged glasses, until he came over and signed up also. Albindroso slammed a $10 bill on the bar and called the redneck out. Hey, fat ass, $10 says my friend rides longer than you. Screw you, northern bitch, I'll fucking outride your mom. What? My mom's not here, you idiot. You just have to outride Hate. The redneck walked off without answering. After a few girls rode the bull, the redneck got on and was thrown after about 4 seconds. A very poor showing. We mocked him mercilessly. He flips us off. We cheer loudly. Hate rode for the full 8 seconds. An eventful 8 seconds at that. The first 4 or so he was doing fine, until the bull reared back and flung him forward. Hate, had he been like the redneck, would have flown off into the cushions. But Hate is sort of like a British pit bull. Once his jaws are locked, nothing short of death can get him to release. As a result, his entire body landed on his crotch, which drove into his hand, which he had tied to the saddle horn. You could almost see him turn green as his entire body weight crushed his testicles against his wrist. But to his credit, he stayed on. Hate, along with Albindroso and Thomas, who at this point have joined in the North versus South discussion, began taunting the fat redneck. Hey, Jethro, how'd I stay on longer than you? Your fat ass alone should have kept you on for more than 4 seconds. Can anyone from the South do anything right? Maybe you weren't fucking your cousin, you'd be able to hold on tighter. I thought the North wasn't worth a shit. I've never even seen a mechanical bull before tonight, and I outrode your sorry ass. The redneck flips off again, yells a stream of non sequiturs that had presumably intended as disparaging remarks, and storms off with his friends. This enrages Haight. He owes you $10! El Benjaroso and I convince Haight that it's okay. In this case, a moral victory is sufficient. The mechanical bull interlude over, the wrestling began again. Everything stayed calm for a while. The two wrestlers were incredibly fat, but they were using props, trash cans and such, and fake blood, so it was entertaining. I went to the bathroom, and when I get back, Haight had disappeared again. I found him up against the ring, trying to grab one of the wrestlers by the ankle. I run over to the ring, where the bouncers had pulled him off the ring, and were trying to calm him down. He did not respond to them agreeably. At this point, dealing with Haight was like taking a leashed pit bull to the Westminster Dog Show. I assist the bouncers on having Haight move away from the ring, and then he and I end up in the area where the fat redneck and his entourage are. By this time, Motorbike Mike has come down to hang out with his myriad cousins and girlfriend. Haight, seeing the fat redneck, demands El Benjaroso's $10. Motorbike Mike and I try to break them up, when Haight realizes who he is and yells at him, "You fuck your cousin, you inbred bitch! Give my $10! I'll kick both your southern white trash asses!" And then hell starts breaking loose again. The bouncers lose their patience with Haight, and three of them, plus Motorbike Mike, pick him up and literally toss him out the back door. It was a scene straight out of Roadhouse. I go to find everyone else still at the bar and tell them that Haight has been thrown out. El Benjaroso and Thomas are drunk, hanging all over each other, telling college stories to each other that both were there for. Brian Hall is talking to the only female bartender with a full set of teeth, and Golden Boy is cheering the wrestlers, urging them to spill more fake blood. When El Benjaroso gets drunk, violence tends to follow. Provoked by the knowledge of Haight's ejection from the bar, El Benjaroso begins smashing ashtrays and flinging them off the bar. This upsets the bar manager, who pulls me aside. "Son, I think it's time you and your friends left." "Yes, sir, I agree wholeheartedly. Let me just get them together and we'll promptly leave." I huddle everyone together and explain the situation. We're getting kicked out. As I herd them to the door, Haight walks up. "Hey, guys. What are you doing here? You just got kicked out." "It'll take more than that to keep me out of here. I paid my $2. I've got a brace up. I'm getting my goddamn money's worth." "Fine." I tell him we've been kicked out anyway. It's time to leave. I get everyone moving towards the door. El Benjaroso is one of the first outside. And as he's waiting for the rest of the group, he sees a truck parked right next to the door. He rears back and kicks the front grill of the truck, twice. I'm still trying to round everyone up when a large redneck comes out the front door and walks straight up to El Benjaroso. "Hey, hey boy. Hey, did you just kick that truck?" El Benjaroso is unsure how to answer. The redneck is large, and El Benjaroso knows he's guilty of the offense charged, but he doesn't seem to want to admit this to the redneck, so he just glares at him. "I asked you a question, boy. Did you kick that truck?" He looks at him. "Who the fuck are you?" That was apparently the magic phrase, because the redneck immediately open-fist slapped El Benjaroso right in the face. Thomas, who was standing there watching, throws his beer bottle on the ground, takes a little crow hop, and swings wildly at the redneck. His aim is not good, and the fight degrades into a poorly choreographed dance, where El Benjaroso, Thomas, and the large redneck are swinging at each other, and alternately moving away so as not to be struck by any counterpunches. Before I can even intervene, I was a good 10 yards away as the first punch was thrown. 10 more rednecks pour out the door. Brownhole and I successfully pull El Benjaroso and Thomas away from the increasingly large group of rednecks and manage to settle things down for a second. "Okay, guys, we're leaving. Sorry about any problems, fellas. We're going." The group of now 20 to 30 rednecks crowded around the door are staring and yelling at Brownhole, Credit, Golden Boy, and I as we try to pull Thomas and El Benjaroso away from them. A few seconds later, Haight pushed his way through the crowd of rednecks, emerging on the other side just as one of the rednecks yelled something derogatory at El Benjaroso. Haight, being both loyal and drunk, immediately tackled this redneck, pinning him up against the very truck that El Benjaroso was kicking 3 minutes prior. The events of the next minute are somewhat unclear, but I do remember these images. Haight with his head buried in someone's stomach, wailing at his ribs as other rednecks descended upon him. Golden Boy and Redneck trying desperately to strangle the life out of each other. El Benjaroso and Thomas back-to-back swinging at anything that came close. Credit standing in the street, debating about whether or not he should help his friends. And me and Brownhall trying to pull Haight off his redneck punching bag. Then, the defining words of the night rang out of Brownhole's mouth. "Dude, he's got a fucking gun! Gun, 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 a fucking gun!" The word gun can do strange things to a fight. In this case, it ended it immediately. At those few words, El Benjaroso and Thomas were immediately out on the street with Credit, and Golden Boy and Haight began retreating, hesitantly, with me and Brownhole, into the street. Brownhole and I succeeded in pulling everyone down the street towards the first safe place we can find, a bar called the Oak Room. We walk up a flight of stairs, and there are 3 girls standing at the top of the landing. Haight is the first one to make it to them. "Welcome to the Pi Phi Fall Philanthropy event. It's $2 to get in. Which fraternity are you guys from?" Haight's confused. $2? "I just paid $2 and got in a fight. What the hell is this? Tucker, take care of this. I'm not paying this shit. Where's the damn beer?" Haight pushes his way past the girls towards the bar area. "Hey, you can't do that. It's $2 to get in. Excuse me. I don't really need this right now. I try to walk past the Pi-Fi police, but she grabs me. Excuse me, you have to pay $2 and two more for your rude friend. That was my limit. What are you, fucking kidding me? Do you even work here? It's a sorority philanthropy event. It's for charity. If you don't work here, then get the fuck out of my way. I'll drink to charity. Brian Hall ends up paying for the group to get in and throws in an extra 20 to make the girls feel better. He'll do anything to get girls to like him. We all get a beer, myself included. Al Bencheroso buys the round and then huddles everyone together. His speech is not entirely lucid. All right, guys, seriously. Guns, okay? We cannot go anywhere without each other. We could die, for real, from the guns. We cannot leave this bar, said this group. We have to stay together. We could get shot. Understood? Everyone together. We agree. At the time, the group, mired in a fog of drunkenness, misses the irony of this statement. I smirk and head to the bathroom, alone. On my way back, I smile at a beautiful girl, and she gives me a cute little acknowledgement smile back. I wrote the book on pickup lines, literally, so I head over to her and drop one of my favorites. Did you invite all these people? I thought it was just going to be the two of us. She laughed, and I spent the next 20 minutes staring into her deep green eyes, pretending I was interested in the stupid thing she was saying. A beautiful house. It's a shame no one was home. Eventually, remembering my shepherding duties, I looked around the bar to make sure everyone was okay. Much to my dismay, none of my friends were there. I sprint off from the girl, she's still in mid-sentence, and find Brownhall standing near the door, talking to the girl who wanted us to pay to get in. Dude, where is everyone? Brownhall says, oh, the rednecks came up and got them, but I think it's best for us to stay up here. What? Are you fucking retarded? We're the only sober ones here. I fly down the stairs and stumble out to what can only be described as something straight out of a bad 90s remake of West Side Story. On the near side of the courtyard are my friends, El Bencheroso, Thomas, Golden Boy, Hate, and Credit, standing up on benches, pointing, gesticulating, and yelling in a fashion similar to agitated African savannah baboons. On the far side of the courtyard are about 20 rednecks engaged in the same type of ritual male dominance displays. In between this are about 5 large bouncers trying to maintain calm and keep the warring factions apart. Hate decides to charge across the courtyard and barrel into the rednecks. Thankfully for him, one of the bouncers intercepts him and places him in a headlock. Hate does not like this at all and begins swinging at the bouncer's ribs. Presumably, he would have swung at his face, but Hate is 5'6", and the bouncer's face was about a foot above Hate's reach. I help the bouncer move Hate back over to our side and out of the demilitarized zone in the middle of the courtyard. The bouncer takes this as a sign that I'm the sober one in the group and says something to me I have heard many times in my law school career. You need to take your friends and get out of here. Look, man, our cars are in that parking lot. You're going to help us walk there. These fucking guys have guns, and they're very angry with us. The bouncer sees the logic in this and explains the situation to the other bouncers. They encircle us and begin walking us towards our car. The rednecks are none too happy about this, but the lead bouncers somehow manage to convince them not to launch a full-scale assault on us. I can only assume he threatened violence and the inevitable police involvement. We finally make it to Credit's car when I notice that Brownhall is nowhere to be found. It's fucking great. I should leave that disloyal coward cocksucker back in the Oak Room. Scanning the parking lot, I see him. He's walking next to the very truck that El Bencheroso had been kicking earlier, talking to the older redneck driving it. Thomas sees this and yells out, oh shit, guys, Brownhall's gonna get fucked up. El Bencheroso says, Where? Brownhall, we have to back him up. He tears off running towards Brownhall in the truck. The subsequent conversation I did not hear, but was reported pretty much the same from both Brownhall and El Bencheroso. Brownhall had apparently made headway into calming the old redneck driving the truck. This guy not only owned the truck in question, but also the very bar that everything had started in. He was on the way to convincing the old redneck to call off his henchmen when all of a sudden El Bencheroso runs up. Son, your friends are lucky you're here to get them out of this. I kill people like them. Brownhall says, yes, sir. I'm glad we can resolve this peacefully. El Bencheroso runs up. Brownhall, what the fuck? Let's get the fuck out of here. He's got a gun. The old redneck says, a gun? Boy, I got 2 guns. At which point, the old redneck produces a 9mm pistol from a hidden compartment in the truck and held it up alongside his sawed-off shotgun. Oh, shit! El Bencheroso tried to back up so fast he fell over. Brownhall yells at him, El Bencheroso, go away. Go back to the car. I'm taking care of this. Old redneck says, hey, boy, you're the one who kicked my truck. You got to pay for a new grill. Brownhall says, El Bencheroso, come on, let's go. Sorry, sir, my friend needs to get home. He's very drunk. Your grill looks fine. Who's going to pay for a new grill for my truck? God damn it. The bouncers thankfully reintervened at this point. Everyone piled in a credit card. Being the sober one, I drove over to Golden Boy's car, and Golden Boy and Brownhall got out. We sat there and watched them get in and then pull off. This is important, because the conversation in the car for the next 20 minutes as we drove to Chapel Hill revolved around this event. El Bencheroso was convinced that we had left Golden Boy and Brownhall to die by the hands of the rednecks. Hate refused to believe that there were any guns involved. Thomas was convinced we're being followed. Credit just fell asleep. It went something like this. Hate, dude, we fucking left Golden Boy and Brownhall. They're fucking dead, man. We left them to die, man. What the fuck? Thomas says, Tucker, man, speed up. Those lights have been behind us since we left Durham. I'm like, everyone, guys, just relax. Brownhall and Golden Boy are fine. The redneck with a gun parked his truck. We're fine, so everyone just shut up. Haight says, what gun are you talking about? There was no gun. Al Benjaroso is angry. Fuck you, Haight. I saw the fucking gun. I saw the gun that the redneck's using right now to kill Brown Hall and Golden Boy. How the fuck could we leave them? They've been shot. We left them. For dead. They're dead. Fuck. There was no gun. Fuck off, Haight. I saw the fucking gun. There were two guns, asshole. Thomas says, seriously, Tucker, just pull into the police station. The rednecks are following us. Haight chimes in. Who cares? They don't have any guns. Al Benjaroso loses it. Fuck you, man. I saw the gun. I saw the fucking gun. Golden Boy and Brown Hall are dead. What the fuck? We abandoned them. Tucker, those are totally the same truck lights. They've been behind us in Serum. Tucker, seriously, start evasive maneuvers or something. Al Benjaroso says, we left our friends. We're cowards. Haight turns to him. Speak for yourself. Fuck you, Haight. I'll fucking kill you. 20 minutes of this, and we eventually made it to Chapel Hill. Golden Boy and Brown Hole were fine. No one was following us. Credit woke up, and everyone told Haight there were indeed guns. We drank some beers, calmed down, and headed home. I was exhausted. Being the only sober one in a group of 9 retarded drunks is not funny. Fuck this. From now on, I'm just drinking and driving. El Benjaroso and Thomas were the last two I dropped off, and I headed into El Benjaroso's place with them to get a beer. I figured I had earned it. El Benjaroso decided he was hungry, so he took out a roll of unopened pre-made cookie dough from the refrigerator, tore off the package, plopped the whole thing down in a cookie sheet, and threw it in the oven, setting the temperature at somewhere around lowest level of hell. He tossed us a few beers, and we relived the night for a while, filling each other in on the parts that the two had missed. After 2 beers, Chrissy came out of her room, groggy and sleepy-eyed, and said to El Benjaroso, what is that smell? He looks around for a second, and then realizes, oh, sorry, baby, that's cookies burning. Okay, can you guys keep it down? I've got to be at work tomorrow. At this, Thomas bolted up and said, keep it down? Woman, we're lucky to be alive! The Blowjob Follies. These stories occurred various times between 1994 and 2004, and were written in July 2004. Blowjobs. The sweet sound of silence. The problem with oral sex is that it's like writing. When done right, it's amazing. But there are just so many ways it can go wrong, and when it goes wrong, it's just not worth it. These are some of my funnier blowjob stories. The first one is Say It, Don't Spray It. High school was the first time I realized that blowjobs would be a painful pleasure. I was dating a girl from another school in my area. Besides being one of the hottest girls I'd ever known, she was also one of the very first girls to give me head. We were both new at it, and she liked me to courtesy tap. That was because I convinced her that, I'm not making this up, it wasn't real oral sex as long as I didn't come in her mouth. Aren't high school girls funny? The first few dozen times she went down on me, I courtesy tapped just like she asked. One time we were in my car, parked right out front of her house because I was dropping her off after a date. Instead of a kiss goodnight, I suggested she blow me goodnight. She thought this was a brilliant idea. I quickly got carried away with the risk and thrill of having her suck my dick 20 yards away from her house where her father, who I hated, was waiting for her to come home. I was lost in the sexual ecstasy of the dangerous youthful blowjob when I heard her let out a little yelp. She immediately sat up, her mouth half open, full of splooge, the excess dripping off her chin, and uttered a muffled, "You asshole." Then she spit the cum all over my face. Sprayed it all over me. I was still recovering from getting my own jism spat into my own face as she jumped out of the car and sprinted into her house. I quickly drove off. I had no desire to face her rifle-wielding father with my face covered in my sperm. Once I was out of imminent danger, I couldn't help but laugh. I had no idea that this would only be the first in a long line of strange blowjob incidents. The next one is Miss Chokes on Dick. One girl I was dating the summer after I graduated high school, Jane, had never given head before she started seeing me. Now, my experience has taught me that whenever a girl tells me, quote, she doesn't normally give head, she inevitably ends up giving me an incredible blowjob. It's the ones who say they never do it that do it the best. Well, Jane was the exception. She was the absolute worst I've ever experienced. I've never even heard of girls worse at fellatio than Jane. Her teeth were all over my dick, she had no rhythm, no enthusiasm, and a mouth that mysteriously never got moist. It was fucking awful. It was a month of painstaking instruction before she finally got good enough that I didn't just stop her after 5 minutes and tell her to jerk me off. She was that bad. After another month or so, she got good enough that she could at least come close to finishing me off by herself. Here's the weirdest part. No matter how much she improved, she never moved her head. She kept her head still, and I would have to move my hips. This was annoying, but I was patient with her because she was stunningly beautiful and I was still young enough to think I was capable of love. One night she was doing a pretty good job and I got very enthused with my hip thrusts when I felt a warm, wet sensation on my crotch. I was laying on my back and I looked down and saw what looked like a lot of splooge. This confused me because even though I was close to coming, I didn't think I'd actually achieved orgasm. The cum was chunky to the touch, very dark, and much more viscous than any semen I'd ever seen shoot out of my dick. My first thought was that she had given me some crazy hybrid VD that made my discharge all thick and chunky. I dismissed that, but my mind was still racing. I couldn't figure out what could be wrong, so I said, "What did you do to my dick?" She looked up at me. The expression on her face immediately gave it away. Oh, my God. "Did you just throw up on my dick? Did you just vomit on my fucking dick?" "Yes, Tucker. Yes, she did." I ended up dating her for another 2 years, because beauty does strange things to the male mind. But she stopped going down on me, and we just focused on vaginal sex from that point forward. The next story is Bullseye. The next incident was a few years later in college, right after I had discovered the art of coming on a girl's face. Even before I made the term dotting her eyes famous, I was a fan of giving the facial. As my climax approached, I moved her onto her back and pulled out just in time, covering her face with a solid 5-roper. Being the neophyte, I had no idea how to aim. I had accidentally shot the first and strongest rope right in her eye. As I finished and collapsed, very happy with myself and proud of my prodigious paint job, I noticed a look of agony and pain in her face. "Baby, are you okay? What's wrong?" I can't see. Jesus, it hurts. It's burning." I helped her scoop most of it out of her eye, and both of us still naked and sweaty, I led her down to the bathroom where she washed her eye out for a good 5 minutes. Apparently, semen does not agree with the eye. I called her red eye for the next 3 hours until she got mad and refused to ever give me head again. Then I apologized profusely. She forgave me until she realized that she had ejaculate in her hair and had to wash it twice to get it all out. Needless to say, there were no more facials for us. After that, she swallowed every bit of my seed like a nun taking communion. The next story is The Phantom Menace. One time when I was visiting some friends and family in D.C., I went out drinking and ended up going home with a girl. I'll be honest, this girl was not attractive. But she was into me, and she was there, and perhaps most importantly, she just gave off a blowjob vibe. You know the type of girl. They aren't good-looking or exceptional anyway, but they just give off a look that says, "I suck dick like I invented it." I was pretty drunk when we got back to her place, but that didn't seem to faze her. We didn't even make it to the bedroom. She grabbed me right as we came in the door, undid my pants, and pushed me onto her white sofa and knelt on the ground in front of me, working me right there in the living room. My God, I was right. She blew me away, literally and figuratively. She must have spent at least 20 minutes filleting me, never once taking her mouth off my penis, slurping at the exact right moments in the exact right places. She was so good, even my ankles started sweating. God bless whoever taught her how to suck dick. As soon as she finished, she went to the bathroom to wash out her mouth. She's one of those types. And I stood up to rifle through my pants pocket and get a condom when I saw the sofa. There was a huge skid mark prominently displayed on her white sofa cushion. I laughed at first. Then I remembered that she drove me to her place, and she lived a good 30 minutes away from where I was staying. As the thought of having to hitchhike 45 miles walked through my mind, she appeared out of the bathroom. Fuck. Thinking fast, I put my pants on the sofa and romantically whisked her into the bedroom, where I had to fuck her at least 3 or 4 times to get her to sleep. Once she was safely out, I snuck out of her room and flipped the cushion. I don't even know if she ever found that stain. The next story is Blowjob Betty. Those previous incidents were from back when I was young and cared about things like feelings and emotions. As I grew older and my soul became jaded, I realized that I could be an asshole and get away with it, so I became more risky with my blowjob activities. One time I was with a girl, we'll call her Betty. She lived in a house with 3 other girls, but they were all out, so we hooked up in a living room. Betty was a master of her craft, and especially loved going down on me. She was hitting the crescendo of her well-conducted symphony of knob slobbing, but right before I felt myself let loose into her mouth, the door to her house opened. Her roommate was barely inside when she saw Betty on her knees, sucking me off like she was auditioning for a porn movie. Betty, lips still wrapped firmly around my penis, hand wrapped around my shaft, heard the noise and looked up. Momentarily, the eyes of the two roommates locked, one walking in the door, the other with my dick in her mouth. At that exact moment in time, 2 things happened simultaneously. I shot my load into Betty's mouth, the roommate screamed and ran back out the door. I had not come for about 3 days before this encounter, unless I had a Peter North-sized 8-roper waiting for her. This did not sit well with Betty, especially because she was not expecting it. Betty tried to take the porn star load, but it was just too much. She was not ready, and still trying to process the fact that her roommate saw her sucking dick, she started choking. Not coughing or a slight choke. The bitch was turning red and dying right in front of me, with my seed as the instrument of her death. I was unsure of what to do. I'd never seen a girl choke on dick before. I thought that only happened in rap songs. After about 5 seconds of watching her retch, the words from the Too Short song Blowjob Betty rang through my head. A young girl died just last night. She choked on sperm in her windpipe. So I did the only thing I could think of. I gave her the Heimlich maneuver. I grabbed her around her chest, just below her breast, and pulled my fist in her ribcage with all my force. After about 3 times, she heaved, coughed my splooge all over the couch, and started yelling at me. "Stop it! Ugh, you're hurting me! Ugh, Stop, asshole! I ended up having to take her to the hospital. Not for asphyxiation. She wasn't choking after all. The comb had just surprised her and gotten her nose. Nope. In my enthusiasm to save her life, I had succeeded in breaking one of her ribs. The highlight of the night was at the ER when the doctor told me I did a very good job with the Heimlich. Apparently, you're actually supposed to break a rib if you do it right. Betty and I could never get the old magic back after that night. It might have been because she couldn't take a deep breath for 2 months. The last story is a satisfying meal. My personal favorite blowjob story happened with a girl I hooked up with only once. I met her in some city, out at some bar on some night. I fucking barely remember what she looked like. Thank you, Dollar Beer Night. I'm pretty sure she was engaged, but it wasn't to any of my friends, so I didn't care. The girl did a pretty decent job sucking me off, especially considering how much I drank, and I finished in her mouth. Like a pro, she kept her lips wrapped around my dick till it was dry. But when she came up, there was this strange look on her face. She contorted her expression a little, opened her mouth like she was going to vomit, which of course made me pull back quickly. Then all of a sudden, burp. The girl belched like a drunken sailor, off of my cum. Easily one of the proudest moments of my life. My Key West trip. This occurred July 2001 and was written in February 2005. When I lived in Boca, I was seeing a girl who had more money than she knew what to do with. Daddy was a big real estate developer in South Florida and loved his little girl. And Tucker loved his little girl's fake tits and black Amex card. As a side note for the poor people, a black Centurion American Express card is reserved for those who spend more than $150,000 a year on other Amex cards. One day I told her that I had never been to Key West. The next day we were on a chartered jet from West Palm Beach to Key West. Had a limo meet us at the airport and take us to a really nice hotel on Duval Street. The plane, the limo, and the hotel all had bars in them, so by the time we got settled in our room, like 11 p.m, we were pretty tanked. I can get used to this. Now, even though Daddy's girl had lots of money, sadly she couldn't seem to afford any brains. She was 18 and had left Florida State 2 months into her freshman year because it was too difficult. Seriously, that's not too difficult as a euphemism for sucked 100 dicks in a month. She was literally just too stupid for Florida State. Too stupid for Free Shoe University! It says, I mean, if this seems hard to believe, it's because you don't know any Florida girls. After a year there, you stop being shocked at these things. Daddy's girl wanted to go to some bars, but she neglected to bring her fake ID, or even realized that she needed a fake ID to get into a bar. I asked her, how do you get into bars? I don't know, in Palm Beach they just let us in. Everyone knows my daddy, or we drink at the Breakers or one of the other country clubs. No one's ever asked me for an ID. Did it occur to you that you aren't in Palm Beach anymore? But I thought everybody knew my daddy. I just blankly stared at her. This is so unfair. It's a good thing you're rich, otherwise you'd have already been spit out of the bottom of the porn industry. What? I told you I don't like porn. It's gross. I just walked off. We get back to the hotel and decide to order champagne and strawberries and go down to the hot tub. Cliche, I know, but look at the girl I'm working with. You can't make Chardonnay out of shit. I know that Cristal gets all the press because rappers have discovered it, but let me tell you something. Cristal is overrated and rappers are stupid. If I want to slang dope or steal a car or lay a fucking rap track, I'm going to go straight to DMX and get into his vice. But for insanely expensive limited edition vintage alcohols, I think I'll get my counsel elsewhere. Thank you. I made the mistake of asking Daddy's girl what she wanted. Ooh, let's get Cristal. Let me guess, what's your favorite TV show? I don't know. I guess The Real World or TRL? Okay, baby, let's leave the ordering to me. The hotel had a great selection, so I got us a bottle of 90 Bollinger Grand Marnier. I think it was $450. It's not every day I have access to an unlimited credit line. We head down to the hot tub. It was a really nice setup. It took a glass and a half of champagne for her to loosen up, but after that it was easy. Top off, panties off, full-on sex in the hot tub, here we come. We finished off and put our robes on. As we walked back toward the lobby, I glanced up at the balcony overlooking the pool area and noticed this guy staring at us. He was zipping up his pants, breathing heavily and sweating. He muttered, "Thanks, you just saved me $9.95. Daddy's girl looks up, and even though she's dumber than a burlap sack, she's not stupid enough to miss this. She immediately busts out in tears, "Oh my god, oh!" and runs back into the hotel. I just start laughing. "No problem, buddy, we've all been there." I don't know why I said that. I've never in my life jacked off while watching other people fuck in a hot tub. Well, I mean, you know, not in person. Of course I jack off to porn all the time, but, you know, porn stars are only objects for our sexual gratification, not real people, so it's okay. Daddy's girl was so shook up and upset that she took 2 Valium to sleep and made us leave at like 6 a.m. the next morning, insisting that we go out the back door. "What if we see him again?" "I don't know. We'll charge him for the show this time." When we got back to Palm Beach, she didn't call me for like 3 days. I called her, and she was not happy to hear from me. "What is wrong with you?" "Well, Tucker, you gave me an STD. "What? Which one?" "A urinary tract infection. I can't believe it." I couldn't stop laughing. For like 2 minutes, she was screaming at me on the phone as I teared up with laughter. I tried to make her understand that UTIs aren't really STDs and that she got the UTI from the bacteria in the hot tub and not from me, but that concept was far too hard for her to wrap her head around. She hung up on me. In a fun turn of events, about 4 months later, I got this voicemail from her. Hey, Tucker, I'm sorry. I guess you didn't give me an STD. I had sex last week with my boyfriend in my parents' hot tub, and the same thing happened. He got tested and didn't have a UTI, so I guess you were right. Anyway, I broke up with him before he found out, and now he won't call me anymore. What are you doing this weekend? Girl beats Tucker at his own game. This story occurred October 2001 and was written June 2004. I met Rachel at some ill-conceived fundraiser for infant amputees with swollen spinal cords. It was thrown by the Junior League or some sort of similar organization dedicated to finding rich husbands for vacuous single women. She was one of the organizers, very good-looking, and seemed normal, which is very significant in South Florida. We talked about the wine. I pretended to listen to her. She loved that I came from, quote, a prominent Florida family, a quote that still sends me into fits of laughter. So we ended up going on a date later that week. The first date, she only reaffirmed my initial impression. Not dumb, but not bright. Not interesting, but not totally repellent. This girl was there as a human being, but that's about it. There seemed to be nothing compelling about her aside from her looks. Despite this, and the fact that she refused to hook up on the first date, something about her kept me into the first date enough to go on a second. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. It was just a feeling that I got, but there was something there I wanted to see more of. Besides, I hadn't had sex in like a week, and she was my best option, so I agreed to a second date. Day two started out boring as well, until I figured out why I had a subconscious interest despite Rachel's inability to hold a conversation. I made a totally innocuous joke about having to pay more when you beat up Cuban hookers during sex, and the girl instantly went from polite but distant to clearly into me. The conversation turned to sex, and it was like a switch was thrown. Everything about her lit up. She became totally engaged in the conversation and actually became slightly interesting. At one point, she got a Cheshire Cat grin on her face, her eyes narrowed, and she coyly asked me, "Are you naughty, Tucker Max?" I look at her. "Who are you talking to? You can't think up anything that I haven't done already. Twice." I didn't know it then, but that exchange would soon have a place of honor in the Couldn't Have Been More Wrong Hall of Fame. Remember when I said she seemed normal? Yeah. I was quickly disabused of that notion when we got back to my place and she took my hands, placed them around her neck, and told me, "I want you to strangle me as you fuck me. Not too hard. Don't choke me and don't leave bruises, but make sure I can feel it." It was a bit awkward at first. Not really strangling her. There are plenty of girls I wanted to choke to death, but more coordinating the act while also sexually penetrating her. It's not easy to fuck with both your hands around a girl's neck, especially if you've never done it before. You're so accustomed to your hands being used for other things, balance, hair pulling, using the remote, that it takes you a while to get a rhythm going. But once I got acclimated, it was kind of fun, choking this girl as I fucked her. The next date, we moved from my hands to my belt, around her neck, pulling on it as I fucked her from behind. The best part was when she was putting the belt around her neck and asked me, "Do you have a t-shirt or washcloth I can use? I need to put something soft between the belt and my neck or it'll leave marks." This girl was straight out of an HBO Real Sex episode, except not ugly. If it was sexual, she wanted to do it, and she wanted it to include pain and humiliation. Over the next 3 weeks, we ran the entire gamut of sexual deviance. First was erotic asphyxiation. Next, we added dominance role-playing, name-calling, and brutally violent ass sex. Then we acted out her mock rape fantasies. Then it just avalanched from there. Tossing my salad, comfy cuffs, kitchen utensils, whips, chains, pain, torture, everything you can imagine, and usually worse. I wonder if her daddy used to spank her when she was bad. At first, I kind of liked it. I mean, I got to beat her up during sex, call her whatever names I wanted, pull her hair, throw her around, fuck any hole I could get my dick in as hard as I wanted, and basically do anything I could think of whenever I felt like it. Nothing was out of bounds. She was like my own personal sexual canvas to experiment on. Pain, torture, and humiliation don't really turn me on sexually, but I had never really done anything like this before, especially not to this extreme. And the novelty was kind of exciting. But every night, some variation of this thought would go through my head. Am I really doing this to her? Did I just stick a carrot in her ass as I fucked her doggy style? After about 3 weeks of this, every time pushing the envelope further and further, I was at the point where I was doing shit to this girl that could literally have got me thrown in jail. I was thinking about filming her consenting to this stuff, Tupac style, because when I dumped her, I did not want the blood on my spatula to be used as evidence against me in a domestic assault case. The true irony was that, in a way, these sorts of things were almost more debasing to me than to her. I pride myself on being so outlandish and outrageous that normal people don't know how to deal with me. But this girl, without realizing what she was doing, was flipping it on me. She was beating me at my own game. No matter what I did, she wanted more. If I spanked her, she wanted to be spanked until her ass was raw. If I spanked her ass till my handprints were plastered on her glutes, she wanted me to spank her till she bled. If I called her a bitch, she wanted to be called a whore. If I called her a whore, she wanted to be called a filthy cunt whore. I'm literally a professional at humiliating and debasing people, but this girl was absorbing my entire repertoire and then coming back and asking for seconds. She was like Tyler Durden in Fight Club, in the scene where he lets the mobster beat him up after catching him using his bar basement for weekly fights. Tyler just lets the guy beat his ass. The mobster hits him and hits him and hits him, dropping fist after fist right on his face. But Tyler gets up, covered in blood, and laughs at him. That's so fucking demoralizing. When someone takes your absolute best shots and instead of retaliating, simply gets back up and asks for more, what the fuck do you do then? That was my best shot. Even though this girl's appetite for pain and degradation was outstripping my ability to hurt and humiliate her, I refused to let her beat me. It wasn't even about the sex or the experimentation anymore. And it was never about the relationship, because aside from the freaky sex, this girl was basically worthless. No, for me, it was about seeing whose limits we could reach first. I had to get her to blink. Tyler Durden didn't have a Fight Club in my basement, goddammit. I started browsing S&M websites, emailing my friends, asking for suggestions, and even consulting dominatrixes for ideas. I was about to run out of ideas when one night it all came to a head. Like every other time she came over, Rachel showed up ready for abuse. I met her at the door, pulled her by the hair into my place, she loved that, and started forcing myself on her, another of her favorites. Believe me, it is not my normal way of greeting people. As I was ripping her blouse off, I realized I had to drop the kids off at the pool. I was about to excuse myself to take a dump when it came to me, something that had to be too much for her. I took her by the hands in my bathroom, dropped my pants, sat on the toilet, pointed to my dick, and looked at her. Start sucking. Now this has got to be the limit. There's no way this girl is going to give me head while I drop a fucking deuce. No way. No girl would do this. No fucking way. So what did she do? Say no? Leave in disgust? Storm out of my apartment in a rage? No. Without a moment's hesitation, she went right to work. Just when I thought I'd won the race to the bottom with this girl, I was proven wrong. Again. How absurd is this? Picture yourself in this situation. Sitting on a toilet in a relatively small residential bathroom, pushing feces out of your ass with a girl on her knees in front of you, still fresh from work in her nice business casual blouse and linen pantsuit, lips wrapped around your cock, working it like a runaway. What would you do? I started pushing harder. I didn't care if I popped a blood vessel in my head and died in the toilet from an aneurysm, Elvis style. I was determined to get her to quit. I thought to myself, I bet this will be the only time in my life where I desperately wish for a disgusting flood of diarrhea. The first turd, sadly it was solid, plopped loudly into the toilet. No reaction. Nothing but continued enthusiasm for my cock. The second turd, nothing. It was like she was just giving a normal blowjob. I kind of leaned back in the seat so the odor would have more room to waft up into her nostrils. The third turd. She started to hit her stride, really working her hand on the shaft and slurping the head. The fourth turd. Aren't her knees at least hurting? This is a tile floor. I pushed and pushed and pushed until I was on the brink of giving myself hemorrhoids when my colon finally just gave up, completely devoid of fecal matter. And Rachel was still going strong. No matter how bad the smell got, nor how loud I grunted, nor how disgusting the gas noises my ass made were, she would not stop. Nose full of fart, mouth full of cock. She never even paused. I don't know how she kept breathing. I damn near choked from the smell, and I was a full 2 feet further above the poop than she was. As I sat there on the uncomfortably warm toilet seat, unwiped, smelling my own shit, my ass sweating and falling asleep at the same time, about to come because she was so good she could bring me an orgasm in a coma, I gave up. Fuck it. If I can beat her, choke her, shove things into her ass, get incredible head in the toilet, and still not find her limits, then she wins. I can't go any further. Now you must be thinking, dude, there are tons of things you could have done that are worse than that. Why not a Cleveland steamer or something like that? I mean, this is a legitimate question. But even I have my limits. I'm not Chuck Berry, and I'm not crossing in the world of defecation for sexual gratification. I know it turns some people on to take a dump on their partner or have them drink piss, but I'm sorry, that shit's just out of bounds for me, literally. I mean, I was willing to race her to my bottom, but not the bottom. I was not willing to go beyond things that I'm comfortable with. The fact that she eagerly sucked me off on a toilet as I took a dump drove it home. This girl meant business. It almost makes my skin crawl thinking about what I would have had to do to hear a no out of her. I mean, I could have brought a dog in and asked her to fillet it, but for fuck's sake, what if she said yes? Then what do? Watch her suck off a Dalmatian while I wait my turn? Hit it from behind as she sucks on Fido's bone? Thank you, but no. I honestly thought I was beat. I even got a little depressed and started moping around South Florida, unsure what to do next. But in a stroke of amazing Tucker luck, I broke her, totally by accident, in a way I never would have imagined. 3 days later, she sat me down at dinner and said, in a very somber, serious tone, Tucker, you need to get serious with me or we can't keep seeing each other. It's humiliating to me that I'm seeing a man that my friends know is also sleeping with other women. I didn't even know what to say. I really didn't. I was totally stupefied by that sentence. Did this girl actually think I would seriously date her? Is this a joke? I mean, it may be a double standard and I may be an asshole, but how the fuck am I supposed to have any respect for a girl who would do the things she did? Especially with me, of all people. At the time, I could only muster one response. Pure, unadulterated laughter. She got pissed and stormed out of the restaurant. I know I should have said something like, you mean when I double penetrated you with produce? That wasn't humiliating? But what your friends think about us is? But I just couldn't. I mean, but you know what? To be honest, I may have gotten her to blink first, but it was a hollow victory. I was like that Korean boxer who beat Roy Jones Jr. in the 88 Olympics. Yeah, I got the gold medal, but everyone in the world knows I didn't really win the contest. The Absinthe Donut Story. This story occurred in November 2002 and was written in November 2002. I used to think that I'd seen everything. I'd experienced so many things that might become jaded with life. Nothing affected me anymore. I was world weary. That was before I drank absinthe. That devil juice is brewed from the urine of Lucifer. Now I know why Van Gogh cut off his ear and why Toulouse-Lautrec painted funny-looking midgets. It wasn't mental illness, it was the goddamn absinthe. A few weeks ago, one of my old friends, we'll call him Rich, was in town to visit. This is the story of that night. 6 p.m. Rich shows up at my place. I haven't seen Rich in 7 years. He has put on at least 60 pounds of muscle. I'm shocked at his size. He is with one of his friends, Eddie. They are both in an elite naval special operations unit that is shipping to the Middle East in a few weeks. Eddie is Hispanic, tall, angry, and muscular. He looks around my apartment as if deciding what piece of furniture he wants to break first. I consider that perhaps this wasn't a good idea. 6:01. Rich says, so Tucker, I hear you finally learned how to drink a little bit. He smiles at me. They have 2 cases of beer with them. I think maybe this wasn't such a bad idea after all. 7 p.m. They tell me that some of the best stories I've ever heard. Many are tales of clandestine and violent death brought upon unsuspecting international terrorists or stories of sex with third world hookers. I think that this is probably a good idea. 7:05, we finish our first case. 7:45, I tell them 2 of my best stories. They're in tears laughing. Eddie tells Rich that he was right. I'm one of the funniest guys he's ever met. I now think this was a great idea. 8:40, we have finished both cases. I'm already 6 beers behind each of them and feeling the alcohol. They look like they could do an Ironman triathlon right now, even after 18 beers. I begin to think that maybe I'm not in their league drinking-wise. This worries me. Then I remember that I'm Tucker Max. I'm no longer worried. 8:45. Eddie thinks my site is the greatest piece of literature in existence. He says that he aspires to be like me. He wants to hear more stories about me ridiculing fat people and hooking up with hot girls. I decide he is one of my best friends. 8:49. We walk to a pasta bar for dinner. The waitress is immediately displeased by our behavior. We usually don't get people as drunk as you coming in here. I decide her attitude needs an adjustment. Do you know who these guys are? They routinely risk their lives so you are free to toss your fat ass around Lincoln Park like some haughty tramp, and you question them? Woman, get us some food and liquor and be quick about it. 8:50. The manager asks us to leave. 8:58. We go to McDonald's. The woman in front of me in line spends more than 5 seconds contemplating an order. This infuriates me. What are you looking for, McSeabass? It's the goddamn McDonald's menu. It's been the same for 10 fucking years. It's all McShit. Just order. 8:59. She quickly departs the restaurant. One might have described her as fleeing in terror. 9:00. I don't know what I want. I just point to the dollar menu and say, give me all of that. 9:05. I am displeased with what I get. I try to send back certain items, like the apple pie. The 14-year-old Mexican boy working the Friday night late shift doesn't understand. I get frustrated and just throw everything I don't like on the floor. 9:07. We decide to play Rich's favorite game from college, window pickle races. 9:09. We have about 8 pickles on the window, each making ketchup and mustard streak trips to the bottom. We argue about who owns each pickle. These become intense, profanity-laced arguments. Military guys use very creative curse words. I didn't even know I had a cock holster or a man-pleaser. 9:14. The last people in the restaurant finally flee in terror. The restaurant is empty. We taunt them and cheer as they leave. They and their small children are all cowards. 9:15. The manager comes out and asks us to leave. Eddie is confused. We can't get kicked out of McDonald's. This is like the DMZ of drunk eating. That's why we came here! 9:16. The manager is a frail Mexican woman. She is very scared of us. She goes behind the counter and then tells us to leave again. She waves the phone at us, threatening police intervention. We go. 9:45. We arrive at the party. I find the friend who invited me and introduce my friends. 9:46. We're apparently drunker than I calculated. My friend is appalled. Dude, man, I told you not to show up this drunk. Apparently he's confused. I politely attempt to straighten him out. Who the fuck are you talking to? This angers him. Man, look around. This isn't that type of party. I spend a good 45 seconds perusing the scene. It is a large townhome. There's a big bar with a bartender. There's a table of hors d'oeuvres. I see several button-down striped shirts, a few anti-war buttons, a couple guys holding glasses of Pinot Grigio. I tell my friend, you, sir, are incorrect. It most decidedly is that type of party. 9:48. We walk directly to the bar. I turn to my friends. Gentlemen, this is going to be a show. You kill terrorists. I destroy posers and idiots. Get a drink and watch the artists at work. These people think they're better than me. 9:48. I order 3 top-shelf vodkas. They only have well. This angers me. What kind of low-rent fucking bar is this? I argue with the bartender. I think he is hiding the good stuff from us. I tell him that my friends kill people for a living, and that unless he produces good vodka, he will become a target of opportunity. 9:50. An attractive girl comes up and asks what the problem is. I tell her that the Ratfink bartender is trying to make us drink cheap donkey piss. She laughs at this. I shamelessly flirt with her. She flirts back. I tell her that flirting is nice, but it's not going to get me drunk. She looks at me seductively and tells me to follow her upstairs. Can my friends come? She smiles. Of course. 9:51. Eddie whispers in my ear, man, I thought your stories were at least a little bullshit, but we haven't even had a drink and we're going to run train. Rich was right. You're the fucking man. 9:52. She takes us to a bedroom. There are a few other people there. They are smoking pot and drinking. There's a solitary bottle on the table with greenish liquid in it. The label has the word absinthe on it. I don't know what absinthe is. Whatever. If it's alcohol, I'm not afraid. 9:53. The girl takes 3 glasses, pours sugar over ice, and then pours the green liquid over the ice. It turns clear. This fascinates us. She hands us the glasses, smiles, and says, this is better than anything down there. 9:54. I take a sip. God damn. My neck muscles flex involuntarily. I can feel my heart start beating irregularly. This shit doesn't fuck around. I drink more. 9:56. The girl starts kissing one of the pot smokers. Eddie whispers to me, you know, so much for the gangbang. I frown back at him. How long have you known women? Dude, they're all whores, except our mothers. Just stick to me, I'll find you some pink stink. 9:59. One of the guys tells us about absinthe. He says he brought it back from Europe because it is illegal in the U.S. Apparently it is very strong, like 160 proof, and supposedly has hallucinogenic properties. I tell him he smells like patchouli oil and bong water. Rich and Eddie laugh hysterically. I have an audience. 10:18. Absinthe is the fucking shit. I'm on my second glass, and I'm fucked and half drunk. Rich and Eddie want to see full-on drunk insult Tucker. Loaded up with hallucinogenic alcohol, I am happy to oblige. 10:20. We station ourselves in the kitchen. A fat girl walks in. It's game time. Well, say goodbye to all the leftovers. 10:21. Apparently this fatty thinks she can hang. The Iraqi army made better tactical decisions. What did you say? What, can you not hear me? Are your ears fat too? The fatty has a look of astonishment on her face as she stares at my friends cracking up. Excuse me? I'm sorry, really I am. I open the fridge. Would you like cheesecake or chocolate cake? Probably both, I'm guessing. She turns and leaves in utter astonishment. Hey, Sarah Lee, I was only kidding. Come back here. My friend likes to go hogging. More cushion for the pushing. It's like riding a moped. I have arrived. 10:23. Rich knows me from undergrad and knows how to provoke me. He says, come on, man. You can do better. There are plenty of people around here to make fun of. Express elevator to hell going down. I give him my voice recorder and a simple order. Don't miss anything. 10:26. I see a girl wearing 2 colored tank tops over each other. This is too easy. Hey, 1985 Madonna, are you going to get the person who did that? Did what? Spilled 80s all over you. She looked at me confused. Yeah, I know. I'd be pissed too if I looked like an extra from Desperately Seeking Susan. 10:29. Eddie points out a girl wearing the standard anti-globalization outfit. It's topped off with a no blood for oil button. Rich whispers in my ear, you gotta get her, Tucker. Come on, man. Do it. For us. For your country. Eddie starts humming God Bless America. 10:29. I storm over. Rich says into the voice recorder, target acquired. We are weapons hot. 10:30. I introduce myself to her as Alger Hiss. She doesn't get the joke. Time to be blunt. So, do you hate the World Bank? Yeah, I mean, I feel that you don't hate the World Bank. I don't? No. You're just mad at your father. You just want daddy to hug you more. What? You were a sociology major, weren't you? No. What was your major then? Cultural studies? Women's studies? English literature. I give her a look of contempt. Did your parents send you a bill for college? Because I know I would have. Did those Marxist literary critique classes help you shelve the books at Barnes & Noble? No, shouldn't you be blocking an intersection right now? How many anti-sweatshop petitions have you signed, even though you have Reeboks on? Very anti-globalization to wear those with your animal-tested clinique makeup made in Nepal. Well, at least you're consistent in your shameless hypocrisy. What a fascist piece of... Wait, you ever wake up in the middle of the night because a couple of cats are clawing each other to death outside your window? That's what it feels like listening to you speak. She tries to throw a mishmash of stammered half-insults at me. I stop her. Seriously, if I stuck...